the state of the war is, as you know, the longer it drags on, the worse it gets for us. And look, in a way, I sort of fell for it. In the opening stages of the conflict, when the war started, it looked like it was very one-sided, very asymmetrical. And I said in the early stages, we are obviously winning this conflict. We're winning the war. As it stood, as it was in that opening weekend, in those first maybe 3 or 4 days. But again, understanding the conflict means you have to understand the weapon systems that are being used, the tactics, the strategic objectives. The war only works for America if it's quick. We have better weapons, but we have fewer of them. And it's not as easy to make them. America's not an industrial power anymore. We don't make the weapons. We don't make enough of them. Our adversaries are the complete opposite. They make tons of weapons. And their weapons are not precise. They're dumb. You know, our weapons are smart. They're AI. They're connected to satellites. They're very sophisticated, but they're very expensive, and we don't make enough of them. Russia, on the other hand, makes 4 million drones a year. 4 million drones every year, and it's native. Iran makes hundreds of thousands of drones, and they actually design them too. We stole their drone design, their Shahed suicide drone. We just copied that model, reverse engineered it, and made one of our own. And that's actually what we're using in this conflict, although we just have far fewer of them. We're looking to buy drone interceptors or even drones themselves from Ukraine. Again, we don't make them. So this is fundamentally the nature of modern conflict. In the era of the Ukraine war, now in the era of the Iran war, you have these big advantages that the great powers think that they have, like Russia going into Ukraine obviously has a manpower advantage, has more equipment, has more money, has a bigger industrial base. And they go in hard and fast, thinking they're going to topple the government and achieve their objectives. There's actually some striking similarities there. And what they then find is that they are ground down by the enemy's defensive capabilities. And it's sort of inverted. In Ukraine, America was supplying all of these defensive weapons for Ukraine and defensive fortifications and intelligence and the Star Shield satellite system. In Iran, it's the reverse. We are now encountering offensive capabilities, actually, which is ballistic missiles, which are very cheap, drones, which are very cheap, mines, unmanned naval vessels. And these are creating a porcupine-like effect and making it extremely complicated to fight the war. So we came in as the vastly superior power, again, with more weapons, more sophisticated weapons, much larger country, thinking that all we had to do was hit Iran hard and then they would fall over. If that doesn't happen, you're in trouble. And that is how the war, as you know, has been playing out. Trump and Israel in concert hit Iran with everything they had. We bombed them over 1,200 times in the first 24 hours. We killed their supreme leader. We sunk their navy. And they had already been severely weakened and damaged in the first war a year ago, back in June. And it wasn't just Midnight Hammer, which is the U.S. strike, the one-and-done B-2 stealth bomber strike. It was also Israel, which a year ago pounded them over 1,000 times and destroyed not just some of their nuclear facilities, but also missile launch platforms. They also destroyed a lot of regime targets, not just the IRGC, but also the besiege. So Iran is already in a weakened state. They got hit with everything the U.S. and Israel have. But now we're entering the third week tomorrow night. And again, those core strategic objectives of the United States have not been achieved. The regime has not collapsed, has not toppled, and there is no sign that it's going to anytime soon. How did we actually arrive here at the end of February, now the middle of March? Well, the timeline was sort of interesting. The whole idea for this conflict began, or I could say that the U.S. began to mobilize for the conflict back in January. And the circumstance in January is that there actually was, or at least there appeared to be, an organic uprising in Iran. There were, according to estimates from Western media, which might not be reliable, there were hundreds of thousands of protesters across the entire country, in every major city, across the whole breadth of Iran. And these protests swelled in size. They went on for weeks. And then the Iranian regime cracked down on them, according, again, to Western media, in an indiscriminate and an extremely violent way. And Washington and Israel were under the impression that that violent crackdown might actually fuel the dissent, might actually fuel the opposition to the government. And so when the U.S. and Israel first considered strikes, it was in a circumstance where you actually had, perhaps, a latent anti-government ground force. That perhaps if the U.S. and Israel destroyed Iranian weapons or scattered the IRGC by killing the leadership, destroying regime targets, then maybe the people could actually seize control of government assets and arm themselves, or seize control of infrastructure or government buildings. And in a word, maybe there would be an opening for there to be some instability in Iran, and maybe, like I said, an anti-government movement actually coalesce and become viable to replace the revolutionary Islamic regime. But that was in January. And the protests appeared to die down almost at the exact same time that we began to ramp up our military mobilization. And by the time the U.S. got all of the assets in place or out of place, by the time we got aircraft carriers and destroyers and half of our air force in the Middle East and most of our personnel out of the bases that were not protected by Patriot missile batteries or THAAD systems, the protest had already been crushed, and had been crushed actually a month ago. So we went into the conflict really just wishing for the best. It's actually a head scratcher. And I think that when all of this is said and done, the history books will show that this was a catastrophe. This was just like a completely unmitigated disaster and ultimately an unforced error, a war of aggression, a war of choice that was conducted with no planning, hastily, without a clear idea of an end game, an exit plan. You could even say a plan in the middle. Like, there just seems to be, from the beginning until the end, no concrete idea of how this would play out. And so when the U.S. went in, we hit them really hard. And where we are 2 weeks later is that the regime is not just intact, it has totally survived. And now the people have rallied behind it. And the people that have survived inside the regime are now hardliners. Who is the supreme leader? Well, it's the former supreme leader's son. His wife was killed. His daughter was killed. His father was killed. All of his colleagues were killed. This is supposed to be the compliant new leader of Iran that is going to be more willing to or likely to engage in diplomacy, that will make more concessions. This is the new government. This is the new regime post-decapitation that is going to normalize ties with Israel. Obviously, it's worse from the point of view of trying to extract compliance. This new Iranian regime is going to be actually vengeful and even more defiant. Not only that, and this is a second aspect of it, in spite of the fact that we've degraded some of their heaviest weapon systems, we sunk their navy, killed the supreme leader, destroyed, according to different estimates, three quarters of their missile stockpile or missile launch platforms, Iran still maintains the ability to strike U.S. allies, assets, bases, and more importantly, shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. So the regime is intact. It has survived, and it's pissed off. It's defiant. It's angry. It's vengeful. They're not going anywhere. And again, there are 200,000 members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. So if you think we killed 12 of them and now it's a chicken with its head cut off, that's not the case. They're always going to have more people that they can promote. And that's because they prepared for this. They knew what this war would be like. They knew how Israel and the United States would strike. They knew our game plan. And so that's why in the buildup to the conflict, they had succession in place, not just the second man or the third man, but down to like the seventh man, the eighth man. In other words, the United States can kill a lot of the leadership before they exhaust the bench in the IRGC. Clearly, as has been demonstrated by the government of Iran, there is no splintering, there is no dissent, there is no factionalism. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard and Iranian government has rallied behind a new supreme leader. They have rallied against the incursion from the U.S. and Israel, and all we managed to do is piss them off. And the second aspect of it, again, is if Iran is able and maintains the capability to launch missiles, and that's all they need to do. They don't need frigates. They don't need a navy. They don't even need an air force. They don't need any of that. All they need are these very crude and cheap and dumb ballistic missile launch platforms and ballistic missiles, and that is all that they need. Because Iran is a big country. It's a big country with mountainous terrain, with a massive population. And the United States, they've bombed with Israel 3,000 targets. They could bomb 10,000 targets. They could bomb 20,000 targets. Will they have destroyed every missile launch platform? Will they have crippled Iran's ability to make missiles, to make new ones and replace the ones that have been destroyed? The answer is no. They can always source the components because they're cheap. They can always move the missiles around because they're very mobile. They could take them apart and build them back up in another place. And they're always going to have a deep bench of soldiers that are willing to do this. And the more that they get hit, probably the bigger the bench grows. And this is what is happening this week. In spite of everything that has been thrown at Iran just yesterday, there were three ships that were hit in the Persian Gulf. Three ships, and many of them not even in the actual strait. There was one that was hit in the Strait of Hormuz. Two tankers were actually hit closer to Iraq, closer to the coastline of Iraq and Kuwait. So we are 2 weeks into the war, entering the third week, and you still have the threat of missiles being launched. Strait of Hormuz is like 40 miles long. It's not big. So you actually don't even need a ton of missiles. You only need three. You only need to hit one ship for all the hundreds of ships that are in the Persian Gulf to know that it's not worth the risk to leave the Gulf, that if they try it, they might get hit. There's not a lot of room there. And the threat is still so bad, the U.S. Navy won't even provide an escort. There's been talk in the past week and a half that maybe the U.S. Navy will intervene and you'll have a naval ship escort a chemical tanker, a cargo ship, one by one through the strait. I have something in my teeth. But they won't even do that. Even the U.S. warships are not willing to go through the Strait of Hormuz. It's too narrow. It's too risky. Iran is still launching surface-to-sea missiles. So even after all this talk, and there was talk about the government will provide insurance for the ships. There was talk about the U.S. Navy will provide an escort for the ships. Trump is begging these companies to keep the traffic flowing. Even in spite of this, the U.S. warships won't even go there. Forget about an oil tanker. Forget about a cargo ship. It's totally closed down. What effect is this having now on the global economy? Well, not only do you have the energy supply constrained because of the shipping choke point, so that's 20% of the world's oil that moves by sea goes through the Strait of Hormuz, so it's a huge energy crunch on the global oil market. But then you also have the effect that this is a pipeline. This is a metaphorical pipeline. So you actually have a flow of oil. It's continuous, which means the oil is extracted, the oil is refined, it's put on a ship, it's sent through the Gulf, through the Strait, to its destination, where it is then consumed. Well, it's not just that the oil isn't getting where it needs to go, but it's backed up. The flow of the oil has been backed up, which means that now Kuwait and Qatar and the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, they have to fill up all of their reservoirs of oil, all their storage capacity for oil is reaching 100%, which means they don't have anywhere for all this oil to go. There's another problem here. So not only is the oil not getting to where it's intended, but where the oil is being made, now the oil's got nowhere to go. So now all of the largest oil producers in the world, in the Middle East, or among the largest oil producers in the world, they're cutting back on production as well. This is a very costly, this is extremely costly all the way around to not have the oil go through, having hundreds of tankers stuck. It's going to be very costly to eventually get them out. It's the cost of storing the oil, and then it's the cost of reducing production and then ramping it back up. And all of this is creating inflation. All of this is creating very severe and acute economic problems for a global economy, which is already fragile. For example, in the United States, what has been the economic game in the United States for the past few years? It is this tricky calibration. How do we increase economic growth without increasing prices? It has to do with interest rates. We have had chronically and persistently high inflation for a number of reasons. Prices are rising. Prices are getting out of control, as everybody knows. At the same time, job market is cooling off. Businesses are not hiring more people. Those that have been fired are having a very hard time finding new work. I think the median time is like 8 weeks or something. People are out of a job for a very long time. Economic growth might be slowing down. Spending might be slowing down. There's some worrying trends there, some recession indicators. And so the question facing the Trump White House and the Federal Reserve is, if we increase interest rates, or rather keep them high, well, then you're going to tamp inflation down and maybe prices can get back under control, and that will alleviate some of the economic pain for the middle class, working class, people living paycheck to paycheck. But if you keep interest rates too high, then businesses might not want to invest, and then the economy can't grow. And so you have a low growth economy. Even if prices stabilize, then people are still not going to get higher salaries. Maybe there's going to be increased unemployment. Jobs are not being created. So you have low growth, which is very bad if you have rising debt. Because in order to keep up with the pace of the rising debt and deficits, you need to grow your way out of it. Conversely, we're cutting interest rates. Cutting interest rates stimulates investment. People are going to take their money out of the bank. Investors, banks, businesses, funds, they're going to take their money out of the bank and they're going to invest it in the economy. And you're going to grow the economy. You're going to get more jobs. You're going to have more business creation. Maybe you're going to be able to grow a little bit more and get out of the shadow of this mountain of debt. But if you cut interest rates, then you also might have an increase in prices. The velocity of money increases. There's going to be more spending. And if there's more spending, there's more demand, it's going to drive the prices up. This is a very delicate equation. This is what got Joe Biden out of office and ultimately Kamala Harris to lose the election. This has obviously been a sore spot for the president as well. He's not happy with the fact that prices have not completely stabilized or then come down. He's frustrated with the Federal Reserve chairman, who is reluctant to cut interest rates and, in Trump's opinion, then unleash economic growth. So it's in the middle of this very delicate game that we're playing, where we might actually ultimately wind up with both low growth and high prices, that now you have an energy shock. Energy is beneath everything else. Shipping, transportation, industry, it's all powered by fossil fuels. It's all powered by energy. Everything moves on freight. Everything moves on ships. Everything flies in planes. Industry, households need energy for their electricity, for machines. You have a global increase in energy cost. You have an increase in everything cost. You have an increase in all prices. And by the way, I don't need to remind you, it's a midterm election year. So think about what we got ourselves into. This is the mind-boggling nature of the conflict. We start a war with Iran. Think about these questions that were just maybe never considered or never got a sufficient answer before we started dropping the bombs. We're planning on going to war with Iran. We're looking for a regime change. Now, to get a regime change, you need a ground force. And we know that. We know that you can't get a regime change without dropping, or rather, just by dropping bombs. We go into it determined that we're going to once and for all confront Iran. It will be decisive, meaning that the regime will be defeated and ousted. That's the stated goal. That's the intention. That's actually the strategic imperative. We go into the war thinking we're going to topple the regime. And the war doesn't work if that doesn't happen. Well, we can't topple the regime without a ground force, with air power alone. But we go into it a month after the protests have ended. We start thinking this is a good idea because there's massive protests. Those will be the ground force. If we hurt the Iranian military, well, the people might take their guns or take their assets or overpower them, and then you get, that's your ground force, that's your regime change. So we need a ground force, but we don't have one. We need to win the war quickly, and that means toppling the regime, but we can't do that. We know that the first thing Iran is going to do if we hit them is close the Strait of Hormuz. We have no plan to reopen it. We have no ability to reopen it. We're in a midterm election year. In order to win the midterms or to be competitive, you need to have a stable economy. You need to be popular. Well, this is not only the most unpopular war in history, but it's also raising all prices. It's also actually going to cause inflation. Closing the Strait of Hormuz necessarily means all prices are going to rise. It's going to increase energy prices. That will increase the rest of the prices. And that effect will linger probably for years. And so when you think about all the constraints, there's a logic to all of this. Was none of this considered? Did they not think through any of it? You really have to scratch your head and wonder what exactly was the plan here? What was the goal? Because again, if you need to win a fast war, then you need to topple the regime. If you need to topple the regime, you need a ground force. We knew that none of that would happen. We knew that we weren't going to topple the regime because we knew we couldn't do it without a ground force, and we knew we didn't have one. We knew they would close the Strait of Hormuz. And if we didn't topple the regime, we knew it would be closed for a prolonged period of time. And if it's closed for a prolonged period of time, there's no way to open it up. You can't destroy every missile in Iran. You can't destroy every mine or mine-laying vessel. And if you can, you can't do it more quickly than they can build new ones. And if you can, you can't do it in such a short amount of time that it doesn't have these ramifications. So in other words, this was in a way inevitable. It was inevitable that we would get sucked into a prolonged attritional war that would hurt the economy, that would damage the political prospects of the Republicans. It was inevitable because we knew it wouldn't be fast, because we knew we couldn't topple the regime, because we knew we didn't have a ground force. So what was the logic here? Now, this is the latest from the New York Times about the crisis in the Strait, about how Iran appears to be winning. It says, quote, Iran has begun laying mines in the Strait of Hormuz, according to U.S. officials, an effort that could further complicate U.S. efforts to restart shipping there. While the U.S. military said it had destroyed larger Iranian naval vessels that could be used to quickly lay mines in the Strait, Iran just began using smaller boats for the operation on Thursday. Again, it's like we go in there bombing their navy, bombing the big stuff. This is our weakness. The current capabilities, the current state of the art of warfare actually favors the defensive side because unmanned vessels, unmanned vehicles are cheap and they're easy to make. Drones are cheap and easy to make. Missiles are cheap and mobile and easy to make. So you can be as big and sophisticated and technologically superior as possible if you can't destroy every single one of these very tiny, very cheap, very robust weapons, you're not going to achieve your objectives. That's the problem. So we destroyed all the frigates. Well, they just started using smaller ships that lay mines, and we can't destroy all of those. It says strikes have hit multiple vessels in the area, some of which Iran claimed responsibility for. On Tuesday, an Iranian deputy foreign minister denied that Iran was mining the strait. In his first remarks since the war broke out, Iran's new supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, said in a written statement on Thursday that the lever of blocking the Strait of Hormuz must continue to be used. The new mining effort is not particularly fast or efficient, but the Iranians appear to be hoping they can lay them faster than the U.S. can clear them and therefore create a further deterrent for ships moving through the strait. The U.S. military said this week that it had attacked 16 Iranian mine-laying ships. So this is the current state of the conflict. And again, it's a head-scratcher because we knew it would go this way. How? One, we knew all this information going in. Two, it already happened. This is exactly what happened last year in June. Almost exactly. Israel started the war in June of last year without the United States. Unlike this conflict, they launched the war in a surprise attack, and they did it with help from inside of Iran. There were missile and drone strikes from inside the country against Iran's leadership. Iran was hit with a cyber attack that disabled its eyes and ears, all of its radar, early warning systems, everything like that. And then Israel came in with the Air Force and they bombed the nuclear infrastructure, regime targets, missile platforms, everything. And they did this for 2 weeks. But within days of that initial strike, Iran fixed all of its cyber problems, got their Air Force off the ground, and then Iran started launching these huge waves of ballistic missile attacks, hundreds at a time. And it didn't take long for these ballistic missile waves and drones and cruise missiles to completely overwhelm Iran's defenses. And what we saw in last year's war is that eventually these Iranian missiles were just slamming into Tel Aviv every single day. And if Iran would shoot down 90% of the missiles or 85% of the missiles, well, if you shoot 100 of them, 15 ballistic missiles are going to get through. And they're going to land in these Western first world developed cities, killing a lot of people and destroying a lot of infrastructure and causing a lot of problems. And it was during that war that Israel was effectively strangled in the same way as the Persian Gulf. And Israeli refugees were fleeing to Cyprus. It's actually a big problem now. And certain Greek islands. And all of the air traffic over Israel was suspended. People couldn't escape the country. And the economy ground to a halt because people were in bunkers for 2 weeks because they were getting slammed with missiles every single day. And that is ultimately why the United States was dragged into that war. Because only the United States could actually finish the job that Israel started. At that time, the U.S. was not being hit. Our bases, our assets, our other allies were not being struck. It was only Israel. We intervened at the tail end and forced an end to the conflict by bombing Iran and then thereby compelling them into a ceasefire, into a truce with Israel. So in other words, we already live this. We saw this. We saw the economics. We saw the attritional aspect of it, the resilience of Iran's personnel and equipment, their ability to build lots of ballistic missiles and launch them without Israel meaningfully being able to suppress this capability. Now here we are in the second week, and we've hit Iran way harder than we did last year, way harder. Way more ordnance, more targets, killed more people, destroyed more stuff, destroyed all the big stuff. And yet, just today, Iran bombed the airport in Bahrain. Iran bombed the airport in Kuwait. Iran bombed a bank building in the Emirates. And this is having a huge effect on the oil. They, like I said, they bombed three ships in the Persian Gulf, so they're choking off the oil. And it's also deeply affecting the Persian Gulf countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council. All these other economies are built on investment, tourism, high net worth individuals, their capital markets, their specialized banking services for developing nations. And many people are now reporting on this, that all of these oil-rich Gulf countries, they were trying to effectively rebrand as modern hubs. We used to think of the Middle East as a barbaric place where this population pyramid of exploding birth rates, very young Muslims were becoming extremely radical and causing terrorism, and they're very low IQ, and so it's creating political instability. That is what we thought about the Gulf maybe 25 years ago. In the intervening decades, the Gulf has rebranded, think Dubai, think Qatar, think Formula One and WWE in Saudi Arabia. They have rebranded as an entertainment, tourism, banking, finance hub. Well, that doesn't really work if you're getting hit with ballistic missiles at a resort. It doesn't help your image if you've got billionaire businessmen and you've got extremely niche banking services and these buildings and airports are literally being bombed. They're being bombarded every day by suicide drones and medium and short range ballistic missiles. It doesn't work. So in other words, Iran has forced us into an unwinnable situation. We can't do regime change. It's impossible unless we escalate, unless we engage in a ground war. Otherwise, it's off the table. And if we can't do regime change, we can't stop the missiles because we can't bomb them into regime change. We can't bomb all the missiles. So the only way to stop the missiles is to kill the people that are firing them and get new people that don't want to launch them. That's off the table. So they say, well, we'll bomb all the missiles. You can't. There's too many of them. The country's too big. They're Zerg rushing us. It's impossible. You can't destroy all of it. You destroy some of it, they build more of it. You bomb one target, they've already moved the missile somewhere else. You kill one guy, there's another guy ready to take his place. And he's angrier. He's pissed off because he liked the other guy. He liked the first guy. And in the meantime, as the days drag on, the economic situation, it compounds. It gets worse all the time. If we can't topple the regime, if we can't stop the missiles, then that means the strait is closed. The energy doesn't flow. The energy doesn't flow. It strangles the global energy market. It increases prices everywhere. It causes panic. And there's a contagion effect. It affects everybody. There's animal spirits involved in this too. Panic sets in. That's why when the Trump administration releases oil from the strategic reserve, it makes the situation worse. You might say, how does increasing the supply of oil make the price of oil higher? Trump unloaded 270 million barrels of oil from the strategic reserves. You would think that would ameliorate the supply shock because we've replaced the supply, so the price should stabilize. It actually causes the opposite effect because Wall Street is watching and Japan is watching and Europe is watching. And what they see is that we have unloaded all the supplies because it's a crisis and there's no end in sight and the pain is acute and is ongoing. So if we release it, we're communicating, we have a big problem. So people are going to bet that oil will remain high for the foreseeable future. It drives up the price, actually. In Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, they're cutting production. Their storage is full. So they literally have to shut down the refineries. They have to shut down the oil industry because the oil has nowhere to go. They could start pumping it into these new pipelines they built in the Emirates and the East-West pipeline in Saudi Arabia. But who's to say Iran doesn't bomb that too? So maybe they're worried about using it. They've never used it to its full capacity. And then what's more, all these countries, in addition to the oil crunch and the revenue they're not getting, all these countries are also being strangled because nobody wants to live there right now. Nobody wants to visit there. Nobody's going to invest in their capital markets in the long term because they don't want to have to make a stop over into a city that's being bombed by Iran every single day. So we are in an unwinnable situation. It gets worse all the time. And in particular, it gets bad for Trump because Trump needs to win the election. And so you have this global energy crisis. It's going to cause a global economic crisis. As time drags on, it gets worse. And as time drags on, we get closer to the midterm elections. So what does that mean? It means two things. You're either going to, one, get an escalation. What's the solution? Well, if we can't stop them because we can't bomb them into regime change, well, what's the obvious next step? What's the obvious escalatory step? Well, we could always do other things that will facilitate a regime change. We could always invade. And so that's option one, is if we're not winning the war, if the bombs aren't working, and if the pain is that bad, well, then we'll send in the armed forces and we'll invade and we'll force the regime to come down. I think you know why that's not politically tenable, but that's something that Trump has said he's considering. Pete Hegseth said the same thing, They could always go in that direction. They could go up. The other direction is you back off and you leave. Well, how do you do that? If you create a truce or a ceasefire and you tell the Iranians, we're going to stop bombing you, will you please stop bombing us? Maybe you bring China in on this. China needs the oil. China's being hurt by the energy crunch. They want to stabilize the Middle East. And China is maybe Iran's most important partner. So maybe the U.S. and China get together at the trade talks in Europe this week, and we tell China that we'll get Israel to back off if China gets Iran to back off, and we could call the quits. We could say it's a truce. We could say it's a ceasefire. Iran will stop bombing the Persian Gulf. They'll stop bombing the Gulf, the GCC countries, and we'll get Israel to stop bombing Iran. The only problem with the de-escalation approach is that how do we do this without losing face? Because in the event that we de-escalate, we need a narrative. Because what we said, again, from the outset is we want regime change, and that's what we want, and that's what we're going to get because we run the show and we're the number one power. Well, what happens after 2 weeks? We threw everything at them and they're still standing. Well, now we look like a paper tiger. That message reverberates all around the world. And the message is the U.S. is not as powerful as it thinks it is. Its deterrent credibility is undermined. We made a threat. Iran did not back down, and we couldn't back it up. We signed a check that we couldn't cash. And so now every other country will realize we should adopt the Iran model. We should have a native drone industry. We should buy ballistic missiles. We should buy Iranian drones. Everybody's watching very closely and they're taking notes about this. Iran too, Iran itself. They become actually the strategic victor because they thwarted the U.S. objectives. Even though they are absolutely weakened, even though they are significantly diminished and vulnerable, in a way it's a strategic victory because they have reestablished deterrence. The message is communicated that you tried it. You tried to knock us off and you failed and it backfired. We defended ourselves. We're still here. You went in for the kill shot and you missed. The supreme leader is dead. Well, we'll call him a martyr and we'll appoint his son to pursue vengeance. You bombed our missile launch platforms. Well, we bombed your precious oil and we control the energy trade. We vetoed the global economy. That's what they'll say. We let oil flow to China through the strait unmolested, but we refused your oil. We control the global oil market. We control the global economy. You fuck with us, we put our finger on the button and we shut the whole thing down. You'll think twice next time. That's the message. And it rallies the people to the regime. So if there was any idea in the Western imagination that the Iranian people had this aspiration for liberal democracy and feminism and OnlyFans, and they want to be free of Islamic theocracy, or they don't want sovereignty. Well, what effect does this have? If the United States is absolutely bombing the shit out of your country and your government valiantly and bravely defends your people, well, that increases support for that government. The U.S. is dropping thousands of bombs on Iran, literally causing a Category 7 earthquake, a 7.0 magnitude earthquake in Tehran, maybe dropping bunker buster bombs on their capital city. Thousands of Iranians are dead. Hundreds of school children were killed in the first strike. You killed their leader. And if Iran defiantly appoints that guy's son and says, he was a martyr, we're pursuing revenge, we're going to defend our nation. And if they succeed, what does that do other than endear people to the regime? What does that do other than actually create a rallying effect and the population coalesces around the regime? Probably this is the greatest IRGC recruiting ad ever. Whereas Hamas is destroyed, Hezbollah is destroyed, Jordan's a bitch, the Saudis are a bitch, all these countries are a bitch to Israel. I'll just throw in Qatar and the Emirates so you don't think I'm paid off. The Emirates and Qatar are bitches. They're defenseless. Iran stood alone. That's leadership. That's leadership for its neighbors. That's leadership for its people. So that's a strategic victory. How does the United States walk away from the fight without that happening? They can't really. And this is where you enter the latest statements from Trump and Netanyahu. Trump comes out today, or I should say a couple days ago, and he says, we won. He said, we won. We destroyed all their equipment. We destroyed their Navy. We killed their leader. So we won. I'm claiming victory. It's over. Mission accomplished. That's what we set out to do. Now, obviously, that's a lie. Because what they said is that they want regime change at the beginning. They didn't get it. They didn't get what they wanted. They can't get what they want. So now they're just finessing it. And they're saying, well, what we really meant is that we only want to destroy their military and go home. We don't even want to destroy all their missiles. We don't even want to destroy their nukes. We don't even want regime change. All we wanted was these little other victories that we got. And that is Trump looking for an off-ramp. That's Trump looking for a way out. That's a way for him to reframe it so he can claim victory. And it's bluster. It's obviously fake, but that's something that they need to say. The obvious question, however, and this is what I said a few days ago, is, well, what about Netanyahu? Because again, Trump, our strategic interest from America's point of view is we want to prevent Iran from getting a nuke, and we want to prevent Iran from disrupting the global energy trade. And nice job doing that. But we don't necessarily need a regime change. We just need a compliant regime. We don't need the regime to be forcibly, violently removed. We just need them to work with us a little bit. Now, does degrading their military maybe get them to make a deal? Maybe Trump was convinced of this, that he could go in hard and fast, blow up a lot of their shit, go home, and then say, hey, well, mission accomplished, and now maybe the Iranians will make a deal because they don't want to face our wrath again. But Israel is the outstanding variable. They are still the uncertainty because Israel does want a regime change. For them, that's non-negotiable. For them, they want regime change in itself. They don't want regime change to make Iran more compliant. They don't want regime change so Iran will not pursue a nuke. They want regime change because they don't want an Islamist anti-Israel government in place. So that was always the question. Will Israel and elements inside the Republican Party and inside the Trump White House, will they allow Trump to walk away from the disaster, to cut his losses? Because Israel's not done yet. And that is what was reported the other day, is that there's a divergence in the two policies, that Israel wants the war to go on after the United States exits, because Israel still is not satisfied because they have different goals here. Well, the big story from today is that Netanyahu gave a speech this evening, and he basically conceded, we're not getting regime change, and it's not going to happen. And that means, perhaps, that he is assenting to President Trump's off-ramp. He has given permission for the United States to exit the conflict. Trump said on Monday, well, we want it to be over. It's going to be over soon. We're almost done. And he's effectively communicating, this is hurting us more than we're hurting them. We got to leave. If Netanyahu comes out this evening and says, we might not get regime change and that's okay. That's his way of telling us we have permission to finish. And this is from the Times of Israel. It says, quote, Prime Minister Netanyahu admitted on Thursday that he was not certain the Iranian people would bring down the Islamic Republic once Israel and the U.S. create the conditions for them to do so. He said, you can lead someone to water, you cannot make them drink. Regarding the potential for regime change, Netanyahu told reporters, we will create the optimal conditions to do this, including airstrikes, as we did yesterday, as we are doing these days, to try to give the Iranian people the space needed to take to the streets. We are delivering crushing blows to the IRGC and the besieged, their street forces, checkpoints, and more is yet to come. Nevertheless, he said, quote, I do not deny it. I cannot say for certain that the Iranian people will bring down the regime. We told them, help is on the way. Well, the help has come and more will follow. We are all hoping for the result of this regime falling. Ultimately, a regime is ousted from within. However the conflict plays out, Netanyahu asserted the Islamic Republic is already weakened. He said it's simply a different Iran. It no longer threatens as it did before. He said it is not the same power. It is not the giant bully that nothing can be done against and that no one can unite against. So he seems to be admitting the same thing that Trump is, which is we're not going to topple the regime. We opened up a window of opportunity for the people, but they're not taking it and they haven't taken it. He says, however, here is our consolation prize. At least we weakened Iran. At least we degraded their capabilities. And now we've demonstrated that Iran is not untouchable. And obviously that is not what they set out to achieve, but that is their way of finessing it and reframing it so that the two countries can claim victory. And so that sounds to me like maybe we will get a truce. Maybe we will get a ceasefire. Maybe peace will break out. I think that one of two things happens. One, you get a false flag. You get an Iranian sleeper cell that does an unbelievable terrorist attack and hundreds or thousands die. It's a mass casualty event, and that galvanizes the American public and the Europeans and maybe even the Gulf countries to actually invade Iran, and we're in a multi-year war. That's option number one, and that's how you get your regime change. Option number two, they don't give up on regime change. That's not in the cards. But what they might do is a temporary truce, a temporary ceasefire. We replenish our ammunition. We replenish our munitions, stockpiles, weapon systems. Maybe we involve other coalition partners, whether that's the Kurds or the Gulf or the Europeans or somebody else. We get a new coalition together, and then we sow the seeds on the ground for a revolution. CIA, Mossad is active in the country. They're getting anti-government forces organized and mobilized. And then in 2027, you get the once and for all regime change operation. We try it again. I think those are the only two options. I think regime change is inevitable. I think that ultimately Iran is going to go. That's what Israel wants. What Israel wants, Israel gets. And unless some kind of black swan event occurs, unless something very strange happens, it seems that we are on an inexorable trajectory towards an Iranian regime change. It's just a question of what the timeline is. Will we get it now or will we get it later? Will we get a ground war with American forces hastily put together in order to save face, not to back down, and we get the regime change now and we're now in a multi-year conflict? Or do we wind it down, we get some space to breathe, chance to catch our breath, and then we go back in a year after we've made additional preparations and maybe we get a better opportunity. Now, the only problem with the latter is that in the interceding time, Iran is going to be able to build more missiles. So look, let's say you get a truce and a ceasefire. Why would Iran stop? They're kind of winning this. Well, they might stop if China asks them to, and maybe they'll stop if they have some assurance that we will stop bombing them. Okay, so we get a truce. Well, weeks will pass, months will pass, and what is Iran going to do? They will seek vengeance. They will build more missiles. They will try to. And what is Israel going to say? They're going to say, Iran is building their missiles again. They're undoing the work that we've done. We mowed the grass, it's growing back. And so will Israel then try to initiate more strikes on Iran very soon? Surely there will be a tripwire. Unlike Lebanon or Syria, Iran could simply close the strait again. It's not like these other countries where you can just have open rein over the airspace. Iran is able to actually hurt the United States. So it's not going to be like Syria where you just go in and bomb them when you feel threatened, when you feel like it. There will have to be a durable peace. But within months, Israel anyway is going to claim, look, they built their missile arsenal back. Think about it. The midterms are in November. Could you foresee that in 8 months, Israel will say, Iran has had 8 months. If you do the math, that means they built 2,500 more missiles. And they're all pointed at Saudi Arabia and Israel and Al Udeid and Erbil and all the other bases. They're going to ask for another war again because this is what we're involved in. It's like I said last year, you bomb Iran once, you're in it for good. You've been drawn in. You've bought it. You have skin in the game now. By hitting Iran once, it makes negotiations that much less likely. Once bitten, Iran is going to actually entrench its offensive and defensive capabilities. They're going to build more of them because they know they're threatened. They know they're under the gun. So we bombed them last year. Now they don't want to talk. Also, they're going to build a shit ton more missiles because they know they're going to need them. And if they're building more missiles and they're not talking, it means Israel's going to beg us to hit them again. Now that brings us to today. We bomb their missiles. It makes negotiations less likely in the future, and Iran's going to build more missiles after we get a peace. So that's why even in the latter scenario, you might think this is a taco. Oh, Trump is chickening out again. Oh, this is the end. Oh, I guess it wasn't so bad. The boots never hit the ground. Just like last year. Yeah, they haven't hit the ground yet. Yet. People said last year, oh, it was a two-week war. No big deal. All we did was drop a couple of bombs and that was it. Until the next time we bomb Iran. And what are they going to say now? Oh, well, look, all we did was bomb Iran 3,000 times. We never dropped any boots on the ground. Yeah, until the next time we bomb Iran. And then we're going to bomb them again. And people are going to say, well, that was... Until eventually we get the regime change. And I don't know how we get out of this without a false flag. Because there is no appetite for this war. Nobody wants it. American public opinion will have to turn. There is no Iranian opposition. There's nothing viable there. So it seems that that will have to be manufactured at some point to get us to go to war. That's the morbid reality. That is the morbid dynamic that we're engaged in. And that's it. And that is our coverage of the Iran war tonight. Not great. Not great. It's a little bit scary. And that's why I said I'm rooting for Iran to win this strategic victory. I saw some people didn't like that. People didn't like that I said I'm rooting for Iran. Let me tell you why I'm rooting for Iran. Some people say, well, I can understand being against Israel, but being in favor of Iran? I used to be like you. I used to think that way. People say, well, they still chant death to America. They're still our enemy. I used to think that too. I'll be precise and specific. Why do I want Iran to hang on here? It's not because I like their Islamic government. I don't care for it. It's not because I'm pro-Iranian. I'm not Persian. I have no affinity with this country at all. The reason why Iran must remain is because the real threat to America is from Israel. It's not crazy. Think of what Israel did to Hezbollah. They put bombs in the pagers. Okay? Now, Israel has infiltrated and subverted America. Everywhere you look, there they are. Billionaire oligarchs, AIPAC, political lobbying, controlling the media, spying on our population. They've penetrated our intelligence agencies, our law enforcement agencies. They are all over our shit. They're on us. If they could put bombs in the pagers in Beirut, in Dahia, what could they do here? And if they could assassinate the Iranian president, which some people believe they did, if they could kill the leadership of Hamas, if they could drop bombs on Qatar, who's to say they couldn't attack America? Or better yet, who's to say they couldn't attack their enemies that reside in America, like a Tucker Carlson, like an American president that doesn't go their way, like any government official that doesn't go their way? Israel has 300 nuclear bombs. They are a nuclear-armed state. They want to expand their territory. They've penetrated and infiltrated the highest levels of American society. And if they have no rivals in the Middle East, there's no check on their power. The capital of global Jewry moves from New York City to Jerusalem, to Tel Aviv, to Israel. And the balance of power shifts away from the United States towards the middle. The leverage that they will have over the Strait of Hormuz, over the Red Sea, over the Indian Ocean, over the Bosporus Strait, over the land and sea routes that connect Asia, Europe, and Africa, the Indo-Pacific and Europe, the United States and these other countries. It will be unprecedented. They're the hegemon in the Middle East. They're a global power. All that oil, all that natural gas, all those data centers, all the capital that is flowing into those sovereign wealth funds, all the capital that has flown into those markets in Dubai, in Qatar, all these countries, these are facilities where money is pouring in. All the raw materials there, the aluminum, the copper, the fertilizer, the LNG, the oil, all that stuff, all under Israel's jurisdiction, all under their control. They become a global power. It's not insane to think that down the line in 25 years, you get an American government that is a complete suzerain to Jerusalem, where the American elites actually do answer to Israel completely, because if they don't, they'll be killed. If the Ayatollah isn't safe, is the American president? The Ayatollah is underground in a country fortified by missiles. They have a nuclear hedge. Is our country safe? What if Israel runs ChatGPT and ChatGPT is integrated into the U.S. military? Because ChatGPT, its brains are in Israel. And who is going to be our AI czar? Alex Karp was just named. The guy's an Israel partisan. Alex Karp, head of Palantir, who flew over there with the whole board after October 7th to give them all the Palantir systems, all the Palantir operating system. He's going to be the AI czar. Sam Altman, another pro-Israel Jew, he is going to be running the U.S. military's AI because Anthropic wouldn't do it. Now ChatGPT is going to do it. And it's got its key stuff in Israel also. Everybody in Silicon Valley, for that matter, is tied to Israel. Sean McGuire at Sequoia, the largest venture capital firm in Silicon Valley, he's in bed with them also. So is Joe Lonsdale at the Founders Fund. He's an Israeli partisan. He's getting tefillin wrapped in fucking Israel. That's Peter Thiel's guy. Peter Thiel's Founders Fund is run by Lonsdale. Stanford Review, Peter Thiel founded. It was edited by Lonsdale. And Lonsdale's an Israel partisan, just like McGuire, just like Alex Karp, just like all these people that are running tech, which is increasingly in bed with defense. Tech is in bed with defense. Drones, AI, cyber systems, even the rocket ships. It's all in bed now with the U.S. military. And if Israel has infiltrated the tech companies through Unit 8200, which they did, then they've also infiltrated our military. And if they could pull off a daring operation like a bomb and a pager, very primitive, for Hezbollah in Beirut, what could they do here? What could they put in our software in the United States? Or the hardware? What could they do to an American? If they could touch the Ayatollah, can they touch the U.S. president? If they can touch the leader of Hezbollah, Hamas, can they touch a dissenting member of the U.S. elite? So that is actually the number one threat, that a fifth column in the United States will have a nuclear-armed regional hegemon backing them up in the Middle East as a base of operations. That's the bigger threat. So I want Iran to exist as a big counterweight to Israel. That is in our interest. Just like we want balance elsewhere, we're trying to balance India and China. We're trying to, you know, in a way, maybe balance Europe and Russia. We want to balance Israel and Iran. We want to balance Israel and this Islamic alliance. Maybe that's a good idea. Get Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Iran as one big coalition, and maybe they hold Israel in check. So some people say, well, I don't care. I say, I don't care if the mullahs die. Well, I fucking do. Because I want the mullahs on the front line. I don't want me to be on the front line. They're on the front line fighting our war, actually. Do you want to know why Israel isn't dropping bombs on you? It's not your turn yet. Okay, in the 70s, they were hunting down the Nazi remnant from the Nazi regime. They were in South America, Mossad, Israeli intelligence. They were tracking down all the Nazi collaborators to haul them to Israel for a trial. And now, then it was Egypt that stood in their way, and they destroyed Egypt. And it was Syria that stood in their way, and it was Iraq, and it was the Palestinians, and now it's Iran. And what happens when America stands in their way? Well, they'll do it to you too. I want Iran. I want Iran to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. I want Iran to fight the Israelis over there so we don't have to fight their fifth column in the United States. I want Israel to be weaker. So I saw some people didn't really get that. They said, oh, he's rooting against America. America's controlled by Israel. I'm rooting for America. But right now, Iran is fighting for America more than America's fighting for America. America's fighting for Israel. Iran is fighting for Iran. But by fighting against Israel, Iran is indirectly fighting for us. So I pray for the martyrs. I pray for the martyrs in Iran. I pray for their martyred Ayatollah. I pray for their martyred IRGC, because they're fighting the war that we are not, that we will not. Who are we fighting this war for? They're not even hiding it. We're fighting it for Israel. I don't blame Iran. I don't blame them even a little bit. Not even a little bit. It's tragic what is happening. All loss of life is tragic. And obviously, I pray for the dead Americans that have been killed by this. But who is responsible for the dead Americans? It is the decision makers that betrayed us to a foreign nation and sent American citizens to fight and die, to kill and be killed on behalf of a foreign nation. That's who bears the responsibility. Who bears the responsibility for American lives? The commander-in-chief of the armed forces that sends them into harm's way, and better only be doing it if it's in the interest of the United States of America. Who's responsible for any American dying? Well, their representative, their sovereign, their head of state, their leader, whose job it is to protect the homeland, ensure domestic tranquility, protect against enemies, foreign and domestic. It's our president that needs to be looking out for us, not Iran, not Israel. Who launched a war that we knew we couldn't finish, that we knew would bear casualties, that has no tangible, conceivable benefit for Americans? It was President Trump on behalf of Israel. I don't blame Iran. I don't hold Iran responsible. Iran is not my enemy. I don't want to fight Iran. I don't want to die in Iran. You say Iran is our enemy. Why? They have a different religion? Why is Iran my enemy? Because they oppress their own people? I don't live in Iran. I'm not an Iranian. That's their problem. They're not my problem. They're not killing me. I have a greater risk of dying on the highway because an Indian has a CDL. I have a greater risk of dying because a black person's driving on the shoulder and cops can't chase him anymore. I'm at greater risk of dying on American public transit than I am because the Iranians went to war with me. We have real problems in this country, real problems that our leadership won't solve. Instead, they send our soldiers not to protect our border, not to protect Americans in our own cities, not to ensure peace on our public transit or public square, but to go and fight Israel's adversaries so they can have as much power and wealth as is literally possible and conceivable for them to have. So who's responsible? Who is the enemy? The enemy is within. The enemy is not, okay, we don't like the mullahs, so we're going to take, what, a little detour? That's the scenic route? Oh, well, we'll just bomb them just on. Yeah, well, we happen to not like them. Fuck it. Let's just kill them all. No, not my enemy. Iran is not the enemy. Muslims are not the enemy. The enemy is within. The enemy comes from within. And the enemy are the people that have hijacked our government and sending Americans to kill and be killed on behalf of their country. That's the enemy. That's the enemy that comes from within. It's the enemy that tells us we're a melting pot, diversity is our strength. It's the enemy that opened our borders to people that hate us and kill us. It's the people that oversaw the destruction of our cities, riots that forced the cops not to arrest criminals. That's the enemy. The enemy is within. That's who I'm worried about unseating. You want to talk about regime change in Iran? I want regime change in America. You want regime change in Iran? You want an uprising over there? I want an uprising over here. I want regime change here. Make Iran again? I want to make America great again. So I see some of these knuckle-dragging idiot conservatives falling for this. That Haim guy, what's that Christian guy's name? He's like some Christian nationalist. I saw him interview the Asian guy, one of the Asian guys. They all look the same to me and they all sound the same. Nice guy, though. But I saw that. I think his name is Matt Haim, something like that. He goes on the show and he goes, I disagree with this take. You're sticking up for the mullahs? No, douchebag. I'm sticking up for America. And, you know, if you didn't just make culture war slop, if you actually did your homework, maybe you'd know a thing or two about this. I've been doing this for 10 years, as I like to remind people every day. Look at the bigger picture. The problem is not foreign aid. We give all this foreign aid money. That's not the problem. They say we're fighting an endless war. Not the problem. Israel's committing a genocide with our tax dollars. Not the problem. None of these things, not the foreign aid, not AIPAC, not the never-ending wars, not the genocide, not the Jewish media. None of these things are the problem. These are a means to an end. All of these things are the mode. These are a means to an end. These are means wielded by a Jewish fifth column inside of our country. Powerful Jews, loyal to Israel, loyal to international Jewry, have hijacked our institutions, are directing American power at their enemies. Hezbollah, Hamas, Assad, the Houthis, Iran, the Shiite militias in Iraq, the IRGC. Directed American power at their enemies to degrade them, to destroy them, to pave the way for an Israeli empire, which is meant to be the seat of a global Jewish empire. And the capital of international Jewry will migrate from New York to Jerusalem. And all our Jewish billionaires, all our Jewish leaders, under fire from anti-Semitism and seeing their promised land built up and enriched and powerful, they will move there. And Israel will grow in size, in territory, in population, in wealth, in prestige, in status. And they will go where they can be themselves. They will go where they can be Jewish. And they will have that country, that empire sprawling across the Middle East, controlling the choke points, controlling the infrastructure, the raw materials, the supply chains, the arbitrage between the continents at the center of the world island, the center of the heartland, which is the center of the world island, and they will also have their influence in our corridors of power as well. They will also have their influence through technology, through political connections. They'll also have their people, their viceroy, inside of our government. That's the biggest threat. That's the problem. You think Iran is the problem? You think Muslims are the problem? They're not the problem. They're an instrument, a tool. The real problem is the sophisticated, sinister adversary that is at the core, the nucleus. All of this other stuff orbits around it. This is at the center of it all. And that's what people are not ready for. That's what people might scoff at, go, a Jewish empire headquartered in Jerusalem? Yeah, well, you thought we wouldn't be at war with Iran right now probably too, didn't you? You didn't think they would use October 7th as a rolling justification to overthrow Assad and invade Lebanon and get us to bomb the Houthis for a year and then ultimately get us into a ground war in Iran, which we're inevitably headed towards. You thought that too, didn't you? I'm sure they would have scoffed 50 years ago if you told them it would have went this far when Israel's trading land for peace and making a deal with the Egyptians. You probably would have scoffed back then if you were alive. So that is the big picture. That's what people are not maybe ready for, willing to grapple with. But that is the new century. When the Israelis said we're going to reset the regional order 50 years, that's what they meant. They meant everything is about to fundamentally change, and it is. And that is even what Netanyahu said today. In his speech, Netanyahu said, we will first become a regional power, and then that will make us a global power. That's obviously the goal by taking out Iran. He said, our Messiah won't come back next week, but he means he's coming back soon. And they're working toward that goal. That's why, as Tucker pointed out, they're wearing a Greater Israel patch on their arm. Because it is about expanding Israeli territory, pushing their enemies geographically further back, and that means pushing them out of the West Bank and Gaza, pushing them out of the Sinai, pushing them out of the territory south of the Litani, maybe pushing into Jordan. And then once they create that buffer zone and destroy all their enemies' militaries, then they can begin work on the temple, the seat of the lawless man. That's the goal. That's obvious, isn't it? People say, well, we're already at war with Iran. What do you like, the mullahs? Mullahs? You don't even know what the fuck you're talking about. What is a mullah, you fucking stupid idiot? They say, well, as long as we're attacking the mullahs, what do you like, Islam? Islam. Give me a break. Islam. Who runs Hollywood? Who runs the media? Who runs banking? Who runs the government? Is it Muslims they're afraid to criticize? Then why, oh, why is Randy Fine in Congress? It's the Muslims everybody's afraid to criticize at the peril of their career, their livelihood, social standing. That's who we're afraid of? It's Muslims that will act like berserkers and lie about you and destroy your reputation or kill you if you go against them? It's them? Doesn't feel like it. Doesn't feel like it lately, actually. Muslims are just the instrument, and they will be brought here, and they will be radicalized, and they will be incited to attack us so that we will hate them, so that we will co-sign Israel's war, thinking there's a mutual benefit, and we will kill our empire to build Israel's. Our empire, and the MAGA movement is a tiny part of it, will be sacrificed on the altar. It will be burned up and destroyed in this attack, so that we can build a foundation for a Jewish empire. And then when they are finished with us, they will wipe their hands clean and they will be done with us. And then we will be their slaves. That's the end game, obviously. We fought all these wars. We destroyed our peace dividend, our MAGA movement, our everything. It's all being burned up. We are the sacrificial lamb. We are the burnt offering. We are being destroyed so that they can create. And then when our country perishes, they will laugh. They will admonish us. They will say it is a curse from Hashem because we became anti-Semitic. We lost the Jews, so now we lost our secret sauce. That is what they will say. That is what they will say. When America crashes and burns, civil war, fire rains from the sky, whatever, they'll say, well, America became anti-Semitic. They abandoned Hashem. And that is why now they're being divinely punished, and it is just. They became Amalek, right? That's what they say. They say it all the time. What did Roseanne Barr say? She said, America will fall. That's literally what Roseanne Barr said. If America abandons the Jews, they will get what they deserve. America will fall. They fucking hate us. These people fucking hate us. They can't wait to see it. They're glad. They can't stand us. They tolerate us. You want to talk about tolerance? They tolerate us. They see us as stupid goyim, and they are just bearing and grinning. Grin and bear it as they gas up the goyim, no pun intended, telling them, hey, we're going to get mass deportations. Oh, we're going to support Trump. Good morning, we are going to win. Good morning, we are going to win. Good morning, we are going... You know, these fucking stupid idiots, they're grinning and bearing it, pretending to be friends with the goyim, waiting to kill us, lying in wait to rise and kill first. It's what it is. Now, what you do with this information, hey, whatever. Like, I would say don't give in to hatred, okay? Don't give in to hatred. Don't be like them. But that's what it is. And you get this Protestant goofus, LARPer, costume wearer puffing on his pipe. I saw this show. I don't know the guy. Maybe he's a nice guy. I don't know him. But he watches a clip and he goes, huh, so Nick thinks Iran should win the war? Isn't that not patriotic? Patriotic. You don't know the first thing about it. You don't know the meaning of the word. Patriotic. For this government? What's patriotic about this? How many dead Americans? How many paralyzed, permanently injured, maimed Americans from Iowa, from Florida, from Connecticut, from, you know, all these people that have now died and been injured in the conflict, was it patriotic to send them to destroy our empire to build another? No, I don't think so. So yeah, I am rooting for Iran. You're right. You got me. Guilty as charged. I'm rooting for Iran because Iran is fighting them over there. They're on the front lines. It's their turn. Are you ready? And ask yourself, are you ready? Iranian Revolutionary Guard, they're willing to die for what they believe in. They're willing to die for their religion and defiance against Israel, against America. What would happen if Israel was bombing us like they're bombing Iran? Where would all of you be? Where the fuck would all of you be? You people that don't want to vote for a Democrat, you're going to get the vaccine because you don't want to lose your job. Where would you pussies be? Do you believe in anything? Huh? Honest to God, think about it. Think about it. They're not different than us. They're not different than us at all. They're human beings. Human beings slaughtered, slaughtered mercilessly, giving up their lives for their country, for their God, facing death bravely, filling the ranks, knowing they'll be struck down. Mojtaba Khamenei filling the seat of his father, knowing that he's almost certainly going to die, just like Hamas did, just like these other the other martyrs did. These are warriors. These are warriors that actually believe in their religion. These are warriors that actually believe in their cause, facing certain death defiantly. What about you guys? What about the fight over here? If Israel's dropping missiles on everybody, would you face death defiantly, or would you go running for the hills? Would you not want to be pictured next to the anti-Semite? Would you not want to get fired from your job? You know, there's a lesson in all this. You know, maybe in some sense, history belongs to those who fight. History belongs to those who care. The Jews care. When they fought for Israel, they had their fight. They were bold, daring, cruel, unscrupulous. You think about the things they've accomplished. You know, by way of deception, they were willing to fight. The Iranians are willing to fight and die. Are Americans, are we willing to do anything? Are we willing to do absolutely anything? That's the question everybody needs to ask. Are we going to make Instagram reels, reaction content? I don't know. The mullahs suck. Okay, buddy. But anyway, that's not a call for violence, by the way. I'm not saying to go. I don't actually think violence is called for in America, but you do need to rededicate yourself to the struggle. It's a very serious struggle against Jewish power. As Catholics, as Christ believers, okay, they're Muslims, we're Christians. As Americans, okay, you need to rededicate yourself to the struggle. And, you know, there's more than one way to give your life. Yeah, they give their lives in their way. We give our lives to the struggle day in, day out, trying to ascend the ladder, trying to wrest back control over the government. And it's important. I think the greatest peril is that we become too much like the enemy. That might be the greatest peril. That might actually accelerate our defeat. And by that, I mean, if we turn to hatred and violence, and even if we, let's say we appoint some brutal dictator and that guy goes to war with Israel, I don't know that that's going to work. Okay, we got to be innocent and cunning. We have to be both. And it's very difficult. In some ways, it's easier. In some like orgy of ecstatic martyrdom, you know, this big climax of battle or something. We have to give our entire lives to this, our whole mind, our whole soul, and for the right reasons, because it's right, because it's just. That's why we have to do it. We have to be absolutely dedicated. That's what it is. These are dark times. These are very dark times. Very dark, very ominous. And nobody feels good about it. So time to get a little bit serious. No, the mullahs are not the problem. If I hear you talking about Islam, you are a fucking goy. Or you're a Jew. Pretending to be.